Welcome to the Gospel Coalition interview series. I'm your host, Colin Hansen, editorial director of TGC. The 15-point humility code at the end of David Brooks's new book, The Road to Character, echoes like a warning siren in our age of authenticity, calling out to the Western world, "You're doing it wrong." The New York Times columnist and New York Times bestselling author of such books as The Social Animal and Bobos in Paradise offers a message more countercultural than what you'll hear from many evangelical pulpits today. Here's a sampling from the Humility Code. "We don't live for happiness, we live for holiness. In the struggle against your own weakness, humility is the greatest virtue. Pride is the central vice. We are all ultimately saved by grace. The person who successfully struggles against weakness and sin may or may not become rich and famous, but that person will become mature." The critical work of writers such as sociologist Robert Bella and philosopher Charles Taylor underlie the narrative, which explores the character development of influential 20th century figures, including Dwight Eisenhower, George Marshall, and Dorothy Day, but also extending back to the great North African theologian of the late Roman period, Augustine of Hippo. Brooks joins me now to discuss why sincerity shouldn't impress, how suffering forms us when responsibility shields us from honesty, and what truly matters in life. Thank you for joining me, David.
Well, great pleasure to be with you.
Let's start by talking about the very opening of the book, the difference between resume virtues and eulogy virtues. How do we move from caring about what others think of us in the moment to what they'll think of us when we're gone?
Yeah, so resume virtues are the things we bring to the marketplace, whether we're good at math or good at spreadsheets or good at selling things. And eulogy virtues are the things they say about us after we're dead, whether we're courageous, brave, honest, honorable, and kind, and capable of great love. And I guess the founding thesis of the book is that we all know that eulogy virtues are more important, but many institutions in our society spend a lot more time thinking about the resume virtues, and a lot of people, including me in parts of my life, have been a lot more clear about how you build character how you build a career than how you build character. And so the book was an attempt to find people who really, at 20, they may not have been impressive, but by 70 or 80, they were really magnificent and wonderful people. I think one thing they did was at some point in their life, they either had what Dorothy Day called a long loneliness, a great hunger for some absolute, something transcendent and something holy, or they found they were humbled by some weakness and they knew they needed to come weakness, and they became aware of sin, and they were raised in a culture that encouraged them to think about their own sinfulness and to struggle against it and to rely on others in the struggle against it. So the book is really about people who lived in a very different moral ecology from our own. And I think in some ways it's not as great a moral ecology, but in some ways it's a much better one.
Well, let's talk about that transition, because you wrote about this in the New York Times as well, but you astounded me with this comment. It was the greatest generation that abandoned realism. So in the book, you're encouraging people to be more skeptical of their desires, more aware of their own weaknesses, more intent on combating the flaws in their own natures, and turning weakness into strength. But I'm wondering, after reading the book, didn't the greatest generation, like Eisenhower and Marshall in World War II that you cite, didn't they learn the lessons that you commend through the suffering of economic collapse and global conflict? I mean, how did it go from learning through those things that you commend as being character shapers to being the generation that, as you say, abandoned realism?
Yeah, well, I think, a lot of it was an awareness of sin. There are people, you didn't have to be religious, but certainly if you were religious, if you grew up in the early 20th century, you just had an awareness of your own weakness and your own sin. And the conventional story of how we move from a culture of self-effacement to a culture of more self-aggrandizement is that it happened in the 1960s, sort of the me generation, the baby boomers came along, and that led to the culture of narcissism that Christopher Lash wrote about, and the me generation, which Tom Wolfe wrote about. And so I assume that the big cultural shift happened in the 1960s, which is the conventional narrative. But when you actually look at the evidence, it happened in the late 1940s. And basically what happened was that that generation had endured the Depression and the war. And so there was a lot of limitation. They lived with a lot of limitation. And when the war was over, they wanted to consume. And so advertising really took off. Consumption really took off. and they had seen the horrors of World War II, and they just wanted to turn the page. And so in 1946, there were a series of books that said, you know, we need to write a new Ten Commandments, and it's not thou shalt not, that's too negative. It should be thou shalt love thyself, and that you're beautiful inside, and you're not broken inside, you're just beautiful. And so it was based on this idea of human nature that we're perfect inside, and it's society that is corrupting us. And that's a very romantic idea. And some of those books, you know, there's a book called The Mature Mind. They were on the number one New York Times bestseller for, 50 odd weeks. Then The Power of Positive Thinking came along. And then there was a guy named Carl Rogers who led something called Humanistic Psychology, which said, you just need to love yourself more, just love yourself. And inside you're pure. And so that shifted the whole psychology of the country over the next 30 or 40 years. And the crucial shift happened in the late 1940s, not in the late 1960s.
How is that even possible from a generation that just returned from fighting Hitler and Japan and was worried about having to fight Stalin? I mean, I cannot understand how that advice would have helped to forestall the war. Is it because Americans didn't have to fight on their own turf and didn't see the horrors in the same way?
I think, well, that's two things. One, consumption played a big role. And if you get super into consumer society, the main message is trust your desires, follow your desires, pursue your desires. And so from an earlier generation that distrusted their desires and said, hey, are these good desires or bad? They're raised a consumer society that said your desires are what you should follow all the time. And that's consumerism. The second thing is, and this is just my pet theory, is they took a look at the Holocaust and a lot of the horrible things that happened in the war, and they just recoiled. They didn't want to face it. They just wanted to turn the page and put that behind them. And it's worth remembering that, you know, in the years after World War II, people didn't really want to talk about the Holocaust. It was just something was too ugly about it. And even in Japan, they didn't want to talk about fascism. And it took a long time to face what had happened. And I think there was just a desire to turn away and not really stare into the evils that had been exposed. And so they went the other way, and they went to an ultra-happy, ultra-upbeat, and ultra self-loving culture. And I think it was just this desire to turn away.
Well, you write, read a lot about sin in this book, and it's already come up a number of times in this interview, but you write, people rarely commit the big sins out of the blue. They walk through a series of doors. And you say something really significant, I think. Sin is a punishment of sin. And it didn't used to only be evangelical Christians, it feels like, in the United States, talk about sin. And even evangelicals today don't really like to talk about it much either. So how does Western culture regain a sense of sin as something that we're all tempted to do, little by little, and sometimes more damaging than we expect, and not as a category that's reserved only for the likes of Hitler and serial killers?
Yeah, so I agree. We have this concept that evil is only pure evil, and that Hitler has it, and then everyone else is good. But I think we all, and this is any Christian knows of this, it's we're all broken in some way. And I think one of the challenges is to understand how we're broken and not get carried away. I think sometimes some of the Puritan theology got too carried away that we're too. I mean, we lost the sense of sin in part because some people used the word sin to be joyless and to punish joy. And some people used it as a punishment to their children, as a mechanism to shame their children. So the word sin went out of favor. But if you, and so I think it's worth reviving, and it's worth reviving for a couple of reasons. First, it reminds us the word sin is different from the word weakness. It reminds us that life is a moral occasion, and that, as C.S. Lewis put it, that every day we're taking a core piece of ourselves with every decision, and we're either making it more holy or more depraved. And if we make disciplined choices, we become a little more holy. And if we make self-indulgent choices, we become a little more depraved. And so it reminds us of moral stakes. And second thing I like about the word sin, it's collective. Weakness is individual, but we all share some of the same sins, and we struggle against them together. And so I think the word sin is worth reviving. The question is how you explain it to people in a secular world or even in the Christian world. I think a lot of pastors don't like to talk about sin because it's so downbeat, and they're trying to fill the pews, and they want to be upbeat. They want to give an upbeat message, and they feel if they're too negative, people won't show up to church. And so I think there's almost a market temptation not to talk about it. But the way I came to think about it, and I learned this from Tim Keller, was if you express it as disordered loves, that we all love a lot of things, but sometimes we put a lower love above a higher love. If a friend tells you a secret and you blab it at a dinner party, you're putting your love of popularity above your love of friendship. And we know that's wrong. And so sin is getting our loves out of order. And virtue is just getting our loves in order, devoting our time to the highest loves rather than the lower loves. And I think that's a way to express it that's not as threatening to the modern sensibility. And a lot of what we have to do is take some old categories and express it in modern form.
Yeah, without, and especially for Christians, maintaining that sense of the biblical teaching, but certainly Keller has been an example of somebody who's helped Christians to understand the category of idolatry as being really related to disordered loves, as being at the core of that problem we've all faced since Adam. I wanted to ask you about Eisenhower. Very interesting chapter. You observe Eisenhower was not a sincere person. I mean, that's akin today to saying he was not a good person. So how did Western culture come to understand whatever feels most natural as our quote-unquote true self, even if it leads to patently evident self-destructive and selfish behavior?
Yeah, and so I'd mentioned Carl Rogers, and this is the romantic sensibility that all evil comes from outside, like social institutions or social class divides, and all goodness comes from inside. And so in this ethos, the desire is to be authentic, the desire is to be sincere. But if, like Eisenhower or his mom, or me, you think that inside we're divided, we're both splendidly endowed and deeply broken, then you don't want to be sincere to your broken places. You want to be better than your broken places. You want to be redeemed from some of the things that are broken about you. And so being sincere, and Eisenhower was not sincere. He was, as I describe in the book, a man given to great anger and sometimes hatred. And if he had been sincere, he would have been an angry, heat-filled man. But he knew he couldn't leave from that. And so he constructed a persona that was insincere, but made him better than he naturally was. And so we had a few cast aside the assumption that we're beautiful and molded inside. Then sincerity becomes a lot more problematic.
Yeah, the contrast, the thing, what you quote from Eisenhower about MacArthur was incredible. I had no idea that was, I mean, I've read enough to criticize Douglas MacArthur for his generalship, but I was astounded by that. What do you make of the contrast between those two figures, really the two most famous figures of that military era?
Yeah, there were really two sorts of generals in the war and maybe two sorts of leaders, the humble and the servant leaders who were self-effacing, and I think Eisenhower would fall in this category. George Marshall would fall in this category. A man who's not as well-known, but who was the mentor to them both, and a truly great man named Fox Connor, who really taught them how to be generals. And they were quiet. There was a general named Omar Bradley. They were quiet and self-effacing. And then there were the showboat generals, who were theatrical. And they had some great qualities. Douglas MacArthur was a genius. George Patton was a great general. But they were all about the show, and they were about the ego and the self-display. And I think over the long run, you want the servant leaders as opposed to the showboat leaders. But there was weird. There was this breakdown between these two sorts of people.
Yeah, interesting that Eisenhower is able to navigate the United States through some of the most tense years of the Cold War, the aftermath of World War II, whereas MacArthur has to be restrained in Korea from essentially inaugurating a World War III. So significant consequences for both of them. I could relate to this statement from your chapter on Dorothy Day. You write, most people shoot for happiness, but feel formed through suffering. The pleasure in suffering is that you feel you are getting beneath the superficial and approaching the fundamental. So I'm wondering, does that mean we seek out suffering, or do we simply accept that sooner or later suffering comes to us all, whether we like it or not?
Yeah, I think we, sometimes young people come to me and say, you know, I want to have my character form. Should I go find some suffering? And my rule is, don't worry, it'll come to you. Most people, by the time they hit a certain age, have experienced some loss or some shame or a romantic setback or the death of a loved one. It just comes. It's part of life. And so what matters is how we whether we make that suffering an occasion for moral growth or not. And those who make an occasion for shrinkage, they don't connect it to a narrative. Those who make an occasion for growth, they connect it to a larger transcendent narrative of redemption. And they take the moment of suffering at themselves, it carves into the floor of their soul and reveals themselves who they are. It makes them more empathetic because they sympathize with other people's suffering. And then they see to turn their moment of suffering into a holy cause. And so I have friends who lost a son, and they didn't say, well, you'll be happy, so grief, let's be happy now. They created a foundation so that other children wouldn't die of the disease that took their son. And they wanted to turn their suffering into a cause and into a transcendent purpose. And so I do think suffering comes in life, and it's what we make of the occasion that really matters.
I talked to Malcolm Gladwell about this related to his last book, David and Goliath. One of the dangers, though, there, isn't it, that when you want to turn that suffering into a good, that you're then tempted to essentially live in that suffering forever. Like you're determined to turn something out of this, but sometimes that can overwhelm you as opposed to being able to kind of move on through forgiveness or something else. Is that a danger that you foresee, though, in that response to suffering?
Yeah. C.S. Lewis wrote about this in A Grief Observed, that if you are mourning the loss of a loved one, you can freeze in time, and that you stay with that moment of the death or the moment of the person who's lost. But of course, they've moved on to another world.
Right.
And so Lewis talked about the it's not a betrayal of them to move on in life. And I do think that's a profound insight. I find among the people I know who I think I really admired, they've been through moments of suffering. And I think sometimes Dorothy Day imposed too much suffering on herself, to be honest. But they've also connected it to a larger purpose. They've connected to a sense of vocation. And so they have, without betraying it, they have moved progressively through life.
Yeah. I'm talking with David Brooks about his book, The Road to Character. The process described in the chapter on George Marshall actually happens in pastoral ministry, just as I think it happens in politics or military or business or entertainment. You write, the higher you go in life, the fewer people there are to offer honest feedback or restrain your unpleasant traits. So it is best to learn those habits of self-restraint, including emotional self-restraint, at an early age. So what do you suggest for young people when they're setting out to look for work for the first time? Or what can you do if you're already in this position of leadership and you have that problem? I'm thinking that this seems to be especially difficult in our age because our current media's climate is obsessed with youth, and it seems impossible to actually find this kind of honesty. And I think I'll just give you an example of how this works out in ministry. You mentioned how institutions submerge the ego. But a lot of pastors these days, they want to start their own churches, or they want to build something from the bottom up. They don't want to take over a church that somebody else built. They don't see it as an opportunity to be able to make their mark in the same way. So essentially, how do we go about soliciting that kind of honesty, which seems practically impossible for people in an age when people are always looking to make their mark or looking to kind of feed your ego when you're in that position of influence?
Yeah. Two things leap to mind. One is having an institutional mindset, which George Marshall did have. And that's an awareness that we're born into the world that's already filled with institutions. They were here before we were born. They'll be here after they die. And our job is to be a steward very often for those institutions and try to pass them all along in slightly better shape, to be formed by the standards of excellence contained in those institutions, and to really dedicate oneself to the larger institution. You think that institutionalist mindset, it reminds you that it's about things that are more eternal than you, and it has a humbling and a disciplinary effect. The second thing I think is important, which Marshall was not always good at, but sometimes, was self-distance, self-reflection. I've become a fan of people who write journals, or people who in prayer every day take an honest look at themselves. They identify their core sin. They say, how does that sin manifest itself in my daily life, and how can I be better? You know, I have a friend whose core sin is a bit of hardness of heart. He's not always, people come to him and he's not always present because he's thinking about his next appointment or whatever. And so at night he lies in bed and he thinks, how did I do at my course in today? And how can I do a little better tomorrow? And I think those moments of self-reflection can lead to gradual progress.
You write that war is a series of blunders and frustrations, which certainly sounds true from what I've read about war, but it also sounds like church ministry. So I'm wondering, how do you make decisions in the heat of the moment when you don't see any good alternatives with no downside?
Yeah, well, Eisenhower had a phrase, let's make our mistakes slowly. And so he was a great believer in patience. George Marshall said, the decision you make is sometimes less important than the timing of the decision you make. And so waiting for a situation to harden before making a mistake. But then I think also regarding each day as a decision point. This is something Franklin Roosevelt did very well, that you don't make one decision and you're cast off. Sometimes you have to do that. I mean, important decisions like marriage, you make that decision and that's it. But other decisions, every day is a decision point. You can adjust it a little more every day as circumstances change. And you can sometimes reverse course if you need to. And retaining that flexibility of mind. A big phrase for me is the phrase epistemological modesty. Epistemology is the study of what we know, and modesty and modesty. And it's just being aware of how complicated the world is and how imperfectly we see it. And therefore, preferring things that are low and steady to things that are daring and transformational. Preferring gradual and constant incremental progress to the revolutionary one-step thing you think is going to solve everything. And so I think that a general gradual series of small steps every day is almost always better to me than the big daring transformational revolution that you try to do all at once.
Well, this is, I mean, it's a deeply countercultural book because what you're saying there sounds in many ways very wise and totally implausible in a Twitter era. I mean, that is simply, it's not the way our campaigns are run. It's not the way businesses run. It's not the way social change seems to be happening today. I'll give you one of the questions I want to ask you here is as a conservative, I really like the sound of what you said here. It's related to this problem. Some people seem to have been born into a world into this world with a sense of indebtedness for the blessing of being alive. They are aware of the transmission of generations, what has been left to them by those who came before, their indebtedness to their ancestors, their obligations to a set of moral responsibilities that stretch across time. But this is what I'm saying, that the pace of social change in areas like sexual ethics, especially as it's driven by new media, just seems to render that kind of continuity obsolete. So I'm wondering, how is such humility before history plausible today?
Well, I think if you read history, it renders one humble. You know, in the course of this book, I really read a lot of and a lot about St. Augustine, and he was one of the most brilliant minds I've ever come across. And there are so many wise people. Samuel Johnson is this book, a great 18th century British essayist. And there are so many people of such amazing wisdom and such depth of understanding. And understanding about the issues that don't change over time. There are certain elemental things about human life that every generation faces, and they don't really get progressively better. We're just facing them over and over again. And one of the great blessings we have is that the dead have left us the example of their lives. They left us the wisdom of their lives. And they've passed down not only things like churches and cathedrals, but also books. And all we have to do is harvest what they've left to us. And so one of the reasons I write about people, all the characters in my book are dead now, but they've left us such wisdom. And if you read St. Augustine, I think you come away deeply, deeply humbled by a man whose genius, whose faith, and whose emotional power was probably greater than anybody we've known. And so all we have to do is learn from him. And that to me is a great instructor in historical consciousness and in the continuity of the human experience across time.
Well, my next question was going to be at Augustine, so thanks for leading me into that. And I think that section is probably the highlight of the book from my vantage point. But You write, we continually want to earn salvation and meaning through work and achievement, but salvation and meaning are actually one in this way of living. When you raise the white flag of suffering and allow grace to flood your soul, only God has the power to order your inner world, not you. Only God has the power to orient your desires and reshape your emotions, not you. That's your account of Augustine. And he comes across as, we even say this explicitly, especially in his youthful pear-stealing days, as a FOMO millennial with this fear of missing out. He says yes to everything except that which truly matters, as you said, say one overwhelming and fulfilling yes. So I'm wondering, in light of that overwhelming and fulfilling yes from Augustine's life, I mean, how would you describe that yes?
Well, he's an interesting case because we now live in a culture, and our young people do, where they're supposed to run their own lives. They're supposed to be captain of their own ships. And so they go to school learning to achieve, and it's all about me. It's my agency. I'm in control. And as Augustine did that, he was a very successful student, a very successful young professional. But he, as he got higher in society, he felt famished within. And so his first instinct was, well, I'll just turn my powers of achievement over to my spiritual life, and I'll take control of that too. And then he came to realize that it was the very act of trying to direct himself that was the problem, and that he could achieve spiritual growth and development and peace and joy by using the tools he used to achieve worldly success, that the logic was inverse, that he had to surrender. And so his famous conversion scene in the garden is really a surrendering of control and a surrendering to God's love, a surrendering to grace. And it was the act of receiving and surrender and renunciation that was the crucial step. And I think that's very hard for us because we're taught, well, if I do the right homework assignment, if I read the right 9 spiritual books, then I'll be able to, I'll come close to God. I'll become a better person. But sometimes it can't be approached as a homework assignment. You can't use the same methods you did to get an A student. You have to just let go. And so I have a great passage in the book from Paul Tillich. And he says, you just have to accept the fact that you're accepted. And that at the moment of that, no great action is required, but everything is transformed. That's tough for us who have been raised to be ambitious, but it's the necessary turn.
Yeah, you're leading again right into my last question. You said you wrote this book to save your own soul. Did you?
Well, it was a step. Writing a book doesn't make you a beautiful person. And reading a book, frankly, doesn't get you there. But hopefully it introduces you to people who did make great progress and did lead really remarkable lives and who did, by the end, generate inner light. And I think we can learn from their example, and the learning process is a lifelong process, so I wouldn't say that I've come out the other end, but hopefully I've taken a few steps along the journey just in the process of getting acquainted with Dorothy Day or Augustine or some of the great people that are in the book. And I hope I'm along the way. It's a journey, and I hope I'm a little further down the journey.
The book is The Road to Character. My guest today has been David Brooks. David, thank you for writing the book, for your columns, and for joining me today.
It's a total pleasure. Thank you.